Hi, John.
Hey, Alex.
Do you know what I hate?
What do you hate?
Waterbeds.
Why? They're the future of the past today.
Oh, God. Are we back in the X-Men run of the 90s?
Yes.
We watched Licorice Pizza. When life keeps handing you anchovies, just cover them up with some extra cheese and make a pizza with what you got. Life is a pizza with everything on top. All right, John, Licorice Pizza. P.T. Yeah. Anderson.
Yes. First one of his we've done.
Yeah, true. What else has he done?
Boogie Nights, Magnolia, Punch Drunk Love, There Will Be Blood, Phantom Thread.
He was There Will Be Blood? Oh, yeah. Shit, I didn't remember that.
Yeah. That's like the start of like new. There's all, to me, there's like, well, it's not just to me, but there's like old school Paul Thomas Anderson, which is Heartache, Boogie Nights, Magnolia. And then Punch Drunk Love is a little bit of a turning point. And then his style really kind of changed after that. And that's really where I like him a lot more. I'm not a big fan of those earlier movies as much.
I like Magnolia quite a bit. Well, I liked watching Magnolia one time. I don't know if it's something I'd revisit.
Yeah, I find it a bit overblown. We've early on in this show, I went on a big rant about the ending of it, and but I just like it went from having soundtracks like sad John Bryan, Amy Mann soundtracks to Johnny Greenwood, more sort of cinematic vibes.
Yeah, soundtrack's still pretty good in this movie though. Mm-hmm. There's some bangers. I was like a David Bowie. I was watching this with a friend that's quite a bit younger than me, and the running out of gas part happens, and she was confused as to what was happening. And I'm like, oh, that was like a real life. I'm like, this is before my time as well, but like right. This was still remembered quite well. But I was like, oh God, I feel like I'm a fucking million years old trying mm-hmm. to explain this shit.
Yeah. Well, I even kind of forgot about some of that when it started. I was like, oh, yeah, because I just remember hearing about it. But, you know, back in my day, we didn't have little lights that would come on when your gas was low. You just had to know.
Yeah. Or just, you know, look at the little, you know,
right
stick that goes towards F.
And who has the time now in this push
but
button?
But back
world?
Then they did.
Back then we had all the time in the world.
The other thing that this movie made me remember, and I had a moment of like, holy shit, I totally forgot about that. Was cash on delivery.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't thought about fucking COD in, I mean, other than Call of Duty, which rocks.
Thank
but
you.
But I haven't thought about fucking COD mail in God knows how. That was like everywhere in the 80s daytime TV.
See, yeah, I just remember it being not allowed. No COD. Because you would see those ads for, you know, 1-800
that's
order
right.
something, and it was always like no COD. And I was like, what is that? Why can't I use fish?
That's right. That's actually probably what I remember better. So Licorice Pizza, here's what I knew about it going in. Mm-hmm. Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yes.
And that there is a problematic age gap in the film.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of this movie, I know that it's Paul Thomas Anderson and there's an age gap in the film.
Right.
This is a very, as you call it, just hanging out movie.
Yeah, it's a hangout picture.
There's not a lot of plot going on. Not a lot of real character growth for the most part. I mean, I kind of loved it, but the person I was watching it with hated it for the same reasons I liked it.
Uh-huh.
Just like, nothing happened and I'm confused. I'm like, yeah, but nothing happened and I'm confused. Therefore, I like it.
Uh-huh. No, it's, and I mean, like going, having seen a bunch of his movies, that a lot of his movies are like this. A lot of his movies are just sort of hanging out, usually about at least two, like very broken men. Phantom Thread is a little bit different, but Phantom Thread's a lot of fun too. But yeah, it's a lot of just sort of, It's not so plot heavy. So I was expecting that going into this, but this is just a hangout picture.
Remind me what Phantom Thread was.
Phantom Thread was Daniel Day-Lewis, and I forget the actress's name. She was an old, but like he's a very persnickety fashion designer, and they start forming a relationship.
Okay, I've not seen it, but I remember that movie coming out. Okay, because he's one of those guys that's kind of. When his movies come out, it's like you take, you know, you pay attention.
People make a big deal. Yeah.
He's like a modern Kubrick, except not nearly as good.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny, like I always think of, there's a quote attributed to Fiona Apple where she said she gave up cocaine because she spent too many nights hanging out with him and Quentin Tarantino and listening to them talk about movies forever was just so fucking annoying.
That's funny.
Which I can believe, particularly if either one of them is on cocaine.
Yeah. So, this is going to be a tough one to like, how do we start talking about this movie?
I mean, you brought up one of the sort of the elephant in the room is the age gap thing, which a lot of stink was made about. Honestly, it didn't bother me. And it didn't bother me because neither one, there wasn't anyone in a position of power in this movie. They're both kind
of... That's a really good point.
...hustling losers. He's like too big for his britches, so to speak. This guy, the lead guy, Gary Valentine, is a child actor who's aging out of the roles he was able to get in just like commercials and stuff like that. But he's also like a hustler, like the way he talks to people and whatever. He's very charming. He's played by Cooper Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman's kid. And like,
yeah,
which is a huge gamble to have the two leads be not, you know, established actors in both him and
Alina. Is he not an established actor?
This is his first role. He was in something called the Trashers.
Holy shit. I mean, he's good.
He's really good.
I just assumed he was a child actor in real life. Oh, fuck.
Yeah. Right. But he's really good. And he's playing basically, it's sort of a take on his story is take on this guy, Gary Getzman, who's a friend of Paul Thomas Anderson, who was a former child actor. And now he's a producer that collaborates with Tom Hanks a lot. But there's a lot of anecdotes from his life that fed into this movie. And it's his relationship, Gary's relationship with Alana. Apparently he wrote this script for Alana Haim, whatever. But like, she's a 25-year-old loser. Like, she doesn't know what to do with her life. She's still living at home with her family and stuff like that. And is like struggling to make a name for herself. She's, when we meet her in the movie, she is assisting a school photographer take pictures of kids, like for picture day. But just feeling kind of stuck and aimless and trapped between teendom and full-on adulthood. And whereas Gary's kind of the opposite, where he's a little bit, you know, he's trying to be an adult, but he's still a kid. Yeah. And so, like, I never really felt like there was this, like, grooming or power dynamic thing going on. Any more that, you know, young teenage relationships have that of the power dynamic shifting of people trying to impress the other one and doing stupid things because you're mad at the other one or whatever. So it didn't bother me that much. I mean, I've read the complaints about it, and that's fine. I don't think it's necessarily unfounded. I just don't. It didn't really hit me as being intensely problematic.
Intellectually, I know the problem of it, but it didn't. Yeah, it didn't hit me as well. And I think the power dynamic thing you bring up is something that I didn't really. That's smart. I didn't really put that together in my head. That he's the kind of hustler, the go-getter. Like, he's the more adult of the two, and she is just like this stilted kind of loser lady. I mean, it's still, I guess, technically wrong, but I think that's why it didn't bother me, is because he's got there's not that power dynamic.
It's inappropriate, and it's addressed several times how it's inappropriate, and that affects their relationship, how it's inappropriate, but it doesn't, it's not the kind of movie that's going to dole out that kind of moral judgment about it, because it is about these two characters and all their flaws, those included. The same can be said, however, for the other, like, before we get too into sort of like too much about this movie, the other big controversy around it was John Michael Higgins and his portrayal of restaurateur Jerry Frick, as he's a guy, as the movie progresses, we find out that Cooper Hoffman's mom.
Oh, I loved him.
Well, like, I think he's a hilarious actor. I love him and everything. You know, I think I first saw him in Arrested Development or something. Best in Show. Fantastic. Great actor. Yeah. But like, that bit's just offensive. Like, so his thing is that he's a restaurateur who opened this restaurant called Mikado, and it's supposed to be Japanese food, and his wife is Japanese, and when he talks to her, he puts on a big, like, Mickey Rooney in
Breakfast at Tiffany's
kind of thing, and she speaks Japanese, and it's not that I'm, like, it is offensive, don't get me wrong, but it's more just like, it's, the joke just doesn't work for me. It just is kind of cringy. It's not saying anything. I feel like about the era or the people involved in it, because it's like, oh wow, people were racist then too, crazy. And it just like it, the fact that it happens twice too is, yeah, I don't know.
It, see, just, I it, like cringy. That. I actually, it won me over the second time, like that they repeated it won me over, because the first time I was like, yeah, that's a dumb bit. But the fact he does it the second time and like is cycling Asian wives, I'm not saying like it's a good joke, but it's a good character, like. That's just some sleazeball 70s dude. I don't know. They just it worked for me as like a gross character. Not gross, but yeah, gross. Like a gross character.
If it was more in line with everything else, like if it felt like more of part of the story, I wouldn't mind so much. But it felt like this sort of external bit they were throwing in there. Like, oh, it'd be funny to do a running gag through this. It doesn't really. Because I even think like the wacky shit with Bradley Cooper later, I think plays more into the overall story. Then, I mean, not just like in terms of elements that happen, but just like Bradley Cooper's character being kind of a weird hustler guy too kind of fits.
We got to get to Bradley Cooper later, but
oh yeah, absolutely.
I didn't understand the relationship with John Michael Higgins and Gary. Like, why do they know each other? It's something to do with his mom. I think I missed something fundamental about how he knows these people.
So his mother, played by Mary Elizabeth Ellis, who most people, if they know her as the waitress in
She's Always Sunny, right?
Always Sunny and wife of Charlie Day. She's great on that show. And I was excited to see her in the trailer for this. I thought she was going to have a bigger part, but no, she doesn't. But still, it's nice to see her. But she is Gary's mom, and she is also his publicist. She is a publicist. And so when she meets them, she has written like an ad for them or something like that.
Oh, of course. Okay, yeah. I get it now. All right. So she'd probably been doing that for a while, so he knows them, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. One of the things me and my watchmate were confused about is like how the hell he knows all these adults. Like he's like friends with the guy at the tail of the cock or whatever.
Yeah. In some of these cases, it's because, you know, he's been in the biz and he's an actor.
Yeah.
I don't want to say hit movie, but a movie that's, well, you know, popular enough that it's a, cause it's basically the character that he's, the old woman character is being interviewed when he's out in New York. That's basically supposed to be Lucille Ball. But,
oh, I get that. Okay.
But yeah, but he's also just like, yeah, he's precocious little shit and wants to kind of ingratiate himself to everyone. And so I like that that at like age 14, he already like, oh no, I have dinner every Thursday at Tale of the Cock. And
yeah.
That's, you know, he just wants to be a player in that way.
I love the way that's introduced too, because so we meet him at school trying to get Alana to go out with him. And it leads us to believe he is an abandoned child. You know, it's going to be like a sob story kind of thing. But it's like, no, his mom's around. It's totally cool.
Yeah.
Like, because it, you know, it seems like, oh, I'm an adult. I'm taking care of my little brother. But it's, I mean, I guess he kind of is, but it's not. I don't know. I guess I was... It was leading me to a place it didn't go. And I was like, oh, this movie's not going to do the easy thing.
Well, it's also like, what a quietly amazing opening in that, like, it's a lot of it is just one shot throughout. Yeah. And Paul Thomas and P.T. Anderson, he likes doing that stuff. But it's one shot focusing on the performances of two nobodies. Like, that's you are investing a lot in this opening thing. And that is, and it worked. It really paid off. I thought they both did a great job. I still am not. I'm not the biggest fan of Alana Haim, but I think she was good.
I thought she was really good.
Yeah, I thought she's great. I just like I don't like the band. I will say my introduction to the band was actually through Paul Thomas Anderson, in that he did a series of videos, and the Hollywood Theater with a local record store, Jackpot Records, will have like these sort of like themed. I don't know, months, but like Jackpot will show a bunch of movies, usually like music based or something like that. And a lot of times they'll have performances beforehand of different artists, and they don't necessarily advertise that. They just say, oh, we're playing this movie. And you go like, oh, I guess there's a concert happening now. I rushed to get over here and the concert's happening. Okay. But before, I think it was Valley Girl. Before that, they played this, they called it a documentary, but it was three music videos from Paul Thomas Anderson of Haim, and everyone was furious at it. Because they just came to see Valley Girl. Right. So by the time the third like song starts, everyone's like, no, stop.
Oh, that's funny.
So I'm tainted a bit. But I always think of that when I see Haim now. So her being in this, I'm just, my hackles go up a little bit. But she was good. She was very good.
That is a ballsy move. But I mean, I guess he knew after, you know, rehearsal or whatever, mm-hmm. that what he had in
it. Yeah, he knew her, like, liked the song, liked one of their songs, then, like, started making videos for them and found out that her mother was, like, one of his teachers when he was young.
Oh, really?
So it was a weird confluence of stuff.
The other thing I love about this opening is very strong, you know, kind of first act. Not that this movie has acts, but very strong first, you know, 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Is it immediately leads to... him having to go to New York. I think it's New York.
Yeah.
He has to go somewhere on press tour. It's like, well, you can't go unless you have a Panama Guardian. And then just immediately he's on the plane with Alana. Mm-hmm. We meet Lance. It's such a fast paced thing. And oh man, I felt so bad for Gary when he sees her with Lance.
Yes.
Which leads to, I love that dinner sequence where he's at the Jewish dinner.
Where Lance is. Yeah. And I love Skylar Gisondo, if I'm saying that name right. That guy's great. He's fantastic and book smart, very funny and good on Righteous Gemstones. He's one of those guys that I'm like, I keep seeing everywhere, and I'm glad every time I do. But yeah, so because he's really putting the moves on her. Because Gary is still like, it's funny because yeah, Gary's like, well, she's not my girlfriend. He's still like a little kid about it.
Yeah.
But Lance is, who's also in the same movie, is like, he's got his sights set on her, and they kind of get together, and yeah, she at some point she invites him over to meet his family, and they're very, very Jewish. They are having, like, I forget what the thing is, but you know, basically to say a blessing, and he's like, oh no, I'm an atheist, I couldn't possibly do that. He's very respectful about it, but just no, yeah, absolutely not. That's not flying.
And that leads to my favorite thing in this. Well, one of my favorite things in this film. I love the way that she deals with this. Runs outside and screams at him, "What the hell was that?" And then turns into, "What does your penis look like? What? What does your penis look like? Are you circumcised? Well, then you're Jewish."
Yeah,
it's such a stupid high energy thing to scream, but I found it very amusing.
Yeah, her outbursts are always pretty great. Because you could feel like the genuine frustration that it's like, well, she's just pissed because like she liked this guy and this was maybe also her ticket out, and then like, what? No, you can't do this to me. Yeah, I that scene was very funny. I didn't start like, and I think that, like you said, that first opening 20 minutes is really great, particularly for a movie that is sort of aimless as this, that you're like, oh, I just have to hang out with these people. Cool. You've set it up in the first 20 minutes that I'm like, I'm enjoying these people and their interactions. So I don't mind that you're just going to take your time with it.
Yeah. And it does take its time with it, but it's also kind of a little too quickly paced at times.
Mm-hmm.
So we're leading into, he discovers the wonders of the waterbed and starts his waterbed business.
Yeah. Because they're brand new. And that, the guy, the waterbed salesman, by the way, that's Leonardo DiCaprio's dad.
I was wondering about that. Cause yeah, he's DiCaprio in the cast. Yeah. I was like, oh, that's gotta be a relative somehow.
Yeah. Who also like was a waterbed salesman at one time.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he starts the waterbed business and then just randomly, so he starts the waterbed business by going to the teenage fair and trying to sell waterbeds, and then gets arrested for murder.
When he goes to try out this waterbed, it's like brand new. They're just a brand new thing. So it's like, oh crap, I bet I can get in on this and sell a bunch and make a bunch of money. And yeah, takes to the teen fair, but then one of his buddies, brothers or something, one of his group, is like, hey, what, so-and-so's got his pipe. What if we like gave people some weed to try to sell him waterbeds? He's like, great idea. And so when the cops come down on him, just like out of nowhere, you're like, yeah, oh, well, they got busted with the weed. But no, it's because he's mistaken identity for someone's murder that happened.
Yeah.
And that was, yeah.
And it's so fast.
You're like, wait, what? Oh, okay. I guess that's done. Okay.
Yeah. And he's like sitting there like chained to to like a bench in the cop shop. And they just drag some guy out. And he's like, nah, man, that's not him.
Yeah.
And they just unlock him. They don't tell him anything. It's so strange. The baby question, I can't imagine you know this off the top of your head, and I probably could have looked it up. When did Miranda rights happen?
1966.
US Supreme Court, so they had Miranda rights.
Yeah.
So fucking 1312 and all that. Yeah. What the fuck?
Yeah. Did you also in the teenage fair, did you catch John C. Reilly?
Oh, I didn't. But the person I was watching screamed, yeah, that was John C. Reilly. Yeah, I didn't notice.
He's Fred Gwynn from the Munsters. I thought that was just a fun little cameo.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's dressed up like Frankenstein. But like that voice is fairly unmistakable. So
yeah, I thought it was, but I also couldn't tell if it was just someone doing a really bad Herman Munster, like the new Rob right. Zombie Munster show.
Yes. Oh, boy. Yeah.
So this is where, I don't have much complaint about her as a character. But this is the one spot, well, it happens a few times, but where he gets out of jail and she's like, what'd you do, Gary? And she kind of starts yelling at him a little bit, like, mm-hmm, he actually murdered someone, and then immediately changes kind of tone and walks across the street with him and everything's fine again. And it's like just the tiniest, tiniest bit away from just being full on Manic Pixie Dream Girl. And I just, it's like, I don't think they quite cross that line.
Yeah.
But it's close enough at times where I'm just, I don't know. I feel like that's not the character. And I think if that's the character, it makes, I think going back to that power dynamic thing, like, I think that makes it grosser if she is a manic pixie, amazing, you know, I can't be resisted girl, not, you know, just a fucking weirdo.
Yeah. And I think it's more just that she's a weirdo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at times it's so close. Manic pixie dream girl.
From French to Russian. That was great. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't notice a girl in French. I mean, fall, but like, yeah. I didn't know how to like end it. Because you have to end the sentence with like an uplift. And I don't know how to say that with girl.
Goyle. Yeah. This movie is perhaps the most joyful movie Paul Thomas Anderson has ever done. Mm. Like, usually his stuff's like pretty dark. Like, The Master is just this clash of wills between two like deeply broken men, and you know, obviously There Will Be Blood, whatever. And while Phantom Thread is something approaching a romantic comedy, it's still like, it doesn't have the kind of just joy that this movie has. It's so like, you know, just sun-drenched and hazy and sweet in a lot of ways. And I think that did a lot to win me over as well. I think I was not expecting that. I was expecting a lot more of like you're saying with like the yelling at him, like the sort of like this brutal power dynamic between them, or that that was really more like, I thought it was effective because it seemed very realistic with the way they're kind of on again, off again, and not wanting to admit their feelings for one another and all that. But I thought it was much, much sort of bigger than that, I guess. So I was pleasantly surprised.
On the on again, off again front, one of the things that I was a little, and it didn't bother me so much, but I was a little thrown by, was how this movie has a lot of kind of implied time jumps without actually having a time. Like, mm-hmm. I think it probably spans maybe like a year, but it also could be 3 weeks. It's very, the pacing versus the chronology of the film are kind mm-hmm. of at odds with each other, which I'm fine with, but I could see it where that would bother the shit out of some people.
Well, it was, I was a very old man watching this because I'm like, why are all these children in charge of this business? How did he get this business? Like, I'm like, you know, I want to see the paperwork because he's running this waterbed salesman thing, and all the kids that he knows are working there, including he gets Alana to be a bikini model. Granted, she is an adult, but everyone else that's working there is a child. It's like, how did that?
Yeah.
How did this happen? But I don't know.
I had the exact same thought. I was like, how did you sign the lease? You're 15. That mm-hmm. doesn't make it.
Yeah. But it's just the fact that I'm thinking about it, I'm like, God, I'm old. Like, who cares, man? Just watch the movie.
I got to be honest with you. I think even when I was young, and I'm probably going to speak for you a little bit, I bet you when you were young, you probably would have the exact same thought.
There was probably some stuff that I would have been, yeah.
I have a note here that as far as weird character beats, 1 second, Alana, I literally just blanked on her name. Goes to Kimiko's, or whatever the hell the name of that restaurant is. And she talks to her friend Frisbee, which I wrote down, which mm-hmm. is a lovely, lovely name. You're in the 70s. Your name is Frisbee.
Great. Yeah.
And they have a weird conversation where Gary is apparently famous for like bugging girls for hand jobs.
Yeah.
Which doesn't strike me as the Gary I know. He doesn't seem the begging type.
That threw me. That was a little strange because I expected more to kind of come of that in it. Well, pun not intended, because Frisbee is like, so you're hanging out with Gary. Like, does he bug you to give him a hand job? Stuff like that. And you see when he's like joking around with his friends that, you know, he's kind of a crass guy sometimes, but like, I don't know. It's not saying he's not capable of it, but it just felt like, Other than her jealousy that something else was going to come.
He's upfront about what he wants. Like, I want to see your boobs. Like, it's straightforward. Mm-hmm. He says his deeds. That's the other thing about this movie is all of the dialogue and all the way people act are nothing like 1973.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has a modern sensibility. They're using modern phrases. Like, they're like, hey, what's up? Like, calling people a bitch. Like, oh, don't be such a bitch. Like, I feel like that was 80s.
I could not tell you.
I can tell you,
okay.
And I'm probably wrong, but I'm going to stridently say it because I'm a white male in his middle ages on a podcast. And that's,
yeah, exactly.
Exactly. I am right about everything until the recording stops and I'm proven wrong by a court of Twitter.
Yeah. And at that point, I've forgotten what I've even said.
Speaking of which, at JawsPod on Twitter.
Yeah.
Come say hi.
Yell at him there.
John's the one that said all the horrible things.
But
he defended the, what's that word that I never remember?
Hebephilia. Hebephile. And I always remember it, and I'm always embarrassed that I remember it. Every time, and I fall for it.
No, but that's the thing is, this sounds like an Alex bit where I just tried to make you say it. I literally never fucking remember that word.
Because there's no need to. You don't need to. Why would you?
Well, because I bring it up often enough that this conversation's happening. So, yeah, the hand job thing's weird. So they're doing phone sales, and there's another weird sequence where Alana just goes like full phone sex operator trying to sell a bed.
Yeah, because he's...
And I guess she's trying to prove a point to him, but I don't really know what point she's trying to prove, because like, is she aware that she likes him? Like, I think this movie would reward a second watch.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think, I mean, there's that one point, I mean, it's a little bit later, but that one point where she's, you know, getting high and talking to her friend. I don't know if it's Frisbee again, but it's like, is it weird that I'm hanging out with Gary and his friends? Like, no, it's fucking weird that I'm hanging out with Gary and his friends all the time.
Yeah.
I think it's that like, that thing where she's having fun and is sort of, you know, stuck in this eternal teendom, but then is also frustrated by that. And so when Gary is like trying to tell her what to do, all right, there's something where, you know, perhaps the power dynamic comes into play because he's this little kid. And they're supposed to be business partners in this waterbed thing. And he's telling her how to sell the bed. He's like, you got to make it sexier, you know, get people to buy it. And so she just like really lays it on to try to shove it in his face. And it was funny because you could see that he's really turned on by it, but also really pissed because it's not directed at him.
Yeah, he plays the scene really well. They both play the scene really well, but his reactions are priceless.
Yeah.
I do like, you know, one of the character traits about her is that she kind of takes on the aspect of wherever she is at that moment. You know, like, mm-hmm. now I'm a waterbed salesperson. You know, mm-hmm. now I'm a phone sex operator. Now I'm an actress. Now I'm a politician. You know, which is just kind of echoes the situation she's in.
Yeah, well, it's just that mid-20s, like, trying to find yourself kind of thing. And it's like, maybe I'll give this a shot. Maybe this is my personality.
Yeah, and so at that point, he realizes, oh, you're a natural-born actress, so why not introduce you to, you know, Lucille Ball or where the fuck that was supposed to be?
Yeah, that was supposed to be some sort of famous casting agent person. I don't know. It doesn't matter, frankly. But it's neat that they reference that.
But I also love her claiming, I like the whole sequence of what she claims she can do, like, speaking all these language or whatever, and then she's like, oh yeah, I do Krav Maga, which is probably one of the only real things she says, which is an Israeli martial art. And she's like, that's some kind of karate, right? I'll just put down karate.
Yeah, because Gary tells her, say yes to everything, because that's, I mean, there's, even in the commercial industry, there's a lot of like, just say yes and then like go watch some YouTube videos and figure it out.
Yeah,
but yeah, as for Gary being a hustler, it's like, just say yes and we'll figure it out later. And
but don't say yes about the nudity thing. I told you not to say.
Yeah. And then he gets all upset again with that because she'll show her boobs in a movie, but won't show her boobs to him. I like it. Like somehow that scene where she's like, do you want to see my boobs? There is something like weirdly sweet about it because there's an innocent thing. It's like, cause can I touch him? And she slaps him in the face and leaves. That it's just these confused people that like can't figure out what they want. I mean, Gary can. Gary knows what you want, but she doesn't know what she wants. And it was very honest in that. It wasn't this like, oh, well, I guess he likes me now. I'm going to fall for him. It was still this asserting herself, but still like doing this vulnerable thing, but then being very angry about it.
I wonder with the kind of dynamic that we're discussing with the age, whether people younger than us would find it more repulsive. Because, I mean, obviously we're from a rougher, more men can't be hurt emotionally generation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the and I think it's not the best way to argue something, but like if you go, well, you know, switch it that, you know, if the girl's 15 and the guy's 28, it's gross that it's supposed to be gross here. I just wonder if someone watches us that's, I don't know, 20 wouldn't be as like flippant as we are because we're, you know, we're from a colder, more, you know, emotionally distant generation where men couldn't be preyed upon.
Well, there's also men. You know? There's also a certain amount of me that's like. Well, that 25, 15, yeah, those are babies. They are baby people. You know, like it's not.
Well,
when you're further away from it, that age gap doesn't seem as large to me. That's, it's still that's like, true. Like what? it's don't get me wrong. I'm not condoning 25-year-olds and 15-year-olds getting together. But I just think particularly in the context of this movie, it doesn't seem like that.
Yeah. Large.
Yeah.
Though just stopping point. She when they ask how old she is. She goes 28, pauses for a second, right. Then says 25.
Yeah.
So I think she might actually be 28.
Which is weirder.
I know. I made that point is 25 to 15, although a massive gap, it's almost like the next level up. It's just a straight, it's a flat 10 years. Yeah, it's an even 10 spot.
Yeah.
But to 15 to 28 feels like, I don't know, that's like crossing line.
That makes her character even more pathetic. Like you're almost 30. You know,
yes,
and it's harder, and you're absolutely right. I completely forgot about that bit, so maybe my whole read on this thing is wrong. But like, it didn't bother. Like, it just felt like someone still just stuck in the middle of something. But 28 is like,
and yeah, just you're 30. I just want to clear the audience here because I hate when like people of our generation or it's a little bit more Gen X people say it, where they're like, oh yeah, we were so hard, we drank out of the hose and blah blah. I wasn't. I'm saying I was raised in a like a horrible way where I'm not in touch with my emotions. I'm not trying to be we're butch men and men couldn't be hurt. I'm saying men can be hurt and it's horrible and we were emotionally abused because that's the way you raise children in the 80s. Just to be very clear here, this is not me romanticizing the horrors that we were brought up with it.
We're broken in very specific ways.
Yes.
That, you know, other generations are too, but they're broken in that way in their own way.
Yeah, I just want to be clear, because it's one of those deals where I think it's wonderful that the generations following us actually are almost allowed emotion as males, and there's a breadth of understanding. Yeah, we didn't have that. It is bad.
I do think, particularly online, and you know, I'm not where all the young people are online, but particularly Twitter, like there is definitely a streak of sort of almost puritanical stuff around sex with some of the younger people that will freak out more about this kind of thing than sometimes is warranted. But that's online. So
yeah, it's also Twitter trends older. So it's probably just a bunch of fucking people our age pretending that they're teenagers. Well,
it's a bunch of, yeah, people, 40-year-olds reading young adult stuff being like, oh my God, this is terrible. How dare you even, like, there was a guy, did you watch House of Dragon, right?
Yeah.
There was a guy losing his mind about the cesarean scene. And like, how dare they even show that on television with a post Roe v. Wade, in a post Roe v. Wade world and blah, blah. And everyone's like, that was the fucking point of it. That this was a decision was not in her hands at all. And he killed her just to get a male heir, and the male heir died. Like, it was a pointless gesture, and he ruined everything for it. But the guy was just like, no, they just shouldn't have shown it.
I mean, also, that's not how movies, like, or that's not how TV shows work. That was made well before Roe v. Wade was,
but like, it's just that,
right
that,
there. But also, childbirth before antibiotics and modern medicine was brutal. I not to say this is,
but it's that kind of thing. Like, all TV is moral. It needs to represent my morality, and it's good. Yeah. Like, only good things can be seen on TV, and I don't want to see bad things.
Yeah, I got it. The House of Dragon, I mean, we'd already watched, like, a whole scene of dudes getting their arms chopped off, and it was pretty brutal, so, like,
yeah,
you know.
I'm just, that was the thing that was trending on Twitter today. That's just why it sprung to mind.
Oh, was that a trend? Oh, I thought it was just, like, one mad guy. Okay.
No, but I mean, like, I saw everyone dunking on that guy, so.
Oh, good. Yeah, he deserves to be dunked on.
But anyway, back to the movie.
So she goes on an audition against Sean Penn, which I was not expecting to see him in this movie.
Yeah.
And she kills it, does it very well. There's some spark between them. So he invites her to go to the Tale of the Cock, and Gary sees him there, and he's very upset. But let me just say this. John, never, ever in a million years, if you said, Alex, name the people that could possibly be in this movie, I would write down every single actor I could think of. Never would I think, oh, yeah. And then Tom fucking Waits would show up for no reason.
Yeah.
And act exactly like I would imagine Tom Waits to act.
Yeah. Well, he's supposed to be, Sean Penn is supposed to be William Holden, the actor William Holden, barely disguised as Jack Holden. I don't know who if Tom Waits is supposed to be somebody. But yeah, there's your power dynamic right there. Because, you know, Jack Holden, he's a name. He's this handsome actor, and he's really just picking her up because he can. And then while they're at the Tale of Cock, and I love the scene because Gary comes in like with his, he's got a couple of high school friends with him, whatever, a couple of girls. And the maitre d' is like, you know, we can do stuff to go. It's fine. And he's like, no,
No,
I want eyeline table. And just that.
Yeah.
It's so fun. Cause he's a child.
Eyeline table is great.
Yeah. But,
I was just going to do the Tom Waits. I love the introduction because it's Tom Waits doing the, what I'm going to need is some diesel fuel, some Everclear, and I'm going to meet you out by the eighth hole. And in my head, I'm like, okay, this guy's just saying crazy shit.
Yeah.
But it turns out, no, those are actual ingredients that are going to be needed shortly when Sean Penn is going to do a cool motorcycle jump with a lot on the back of his motorcycle.
Because this actor is famous for riding motorcycles. And so Tom Waits' director character wants to set up him to jump over flaming something. And so the entire bar, because he stands and makes this whole proclamation in front of the bar. And they go and do it. And as soon as Sean Penn takes off, Alana is just thrown from the back of the motorcycle. And
yeah.
Gary just comes running over to her as Sean Penn drives by.
That's a really nice shot.
Yeah, this whole movie is so nice looking. It's really great. But this movie is so like episodic, and this might have been my favorite episode.
A fun bit. Which leads into like a really intimate moment between them. They hug and he's like glad they're okay, and they end up like lying in bed together, and he reaches over and like hovers his hand over her tit. And then doesn't do anything about it. But they're, like, making eye contact the whole time. Like, she's somewhat, I don't know, accepting of it. But, like, there's, you know. And then he pulls his hand back, which I was like, holy shit. Fucking 15-year-old not grabbing boob?
Yeah, that's... It was surprisingly sweet for what we know about Gary. Apparently, the hand job demanding king.
Yeah. I thought it was... an emotionally bonding moment in the weirdest way, where it's just like, wow, you know, you guys really are getting close by him not grabbing your tip.
Well, and then what I like is, so like they have this like this tender moment, and the next day they're having breakfast together, and there's news of the oil crisis. Alana is immediately furious at him because, like, how do you think? What do you think waterbeds are made out of? Like the vinyl that we need, you know, that's from oil. What are you taught, you know? And so she's just, you fucking idiot, yelling at him again. It seemed like they were, it's funny because it seemed like they were immediately like shutting down the shop. That's what I thought they were doing at first, was clearing it all out. But they were just loading a bunch of stuff in the van to deliver to Bradley Cooper's house, or Bradley Cooper's character's house.
On the vinyl note, I found funny where he's like, I don't know, it's some kind of like space magic fabric made out of, I don't know, rubber. And she's like, rubber's made out of fucking gas too, Gary. No, it's made from the rubber tree.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's like, that's where rubber comes from. I mean, it doesn't matter, but I just,
they're both
like, that's, it's just funny. I like when people scream wrong stuff. I mean, you probably know that about me by now. We're in the midst of the gas crisis, oil embargo, and they end up delivering a waterbed to Barbara Streisand's house.
Mm-hmm.
And Bradley Cooper shows up, and I'm not a big Bradley Cooper guy. I don't dislike him, but like he's never really done much for me. But he is so fucking perfect in this. He steals every scene he's in. He is so great.
Yes, I tend to find him a little bit too actory for me. But I
can see that.
Like one of my favorite bits in and it's not a great movie, but it was a fun kind of garage band version of like Goodfellas was American Hustle. Like it was pretty loose, not that great, but there's one bit where his like FBI agent character is making fun of a different FBI agent character played by Louis C.K. And it's just like he does this little like body language pantomime thing of his character, and it was very, very funny. And
speaking of demanding hand jobs,
yeah, and he was in Wet Hot American Summer. He's pretty decent, you know, decently funny in that.
That's what I liked him in that.
Yeah, but so often, yeah, he seems like this very serious actor and wants to talk about his process or whatever, but. The character he is playing is a real life guy named John Peters, who was an absolute psychopath. And we've talked before about, you know, 80s producers being lunatics. And this guy was definitely one of them. And like back in the 70s, he produced the original A Star Is Born, you know, did all kinds of physical threats on people to get what he wants, and was also very charming, just like the John Peters in this movie. And in fact, when P.T. Anderson was kind of mentioning to John Peters that he was going to wanted to have him in the a caricature of sorts, although it doesn't seem like that far off of him being the movie, Peter's reaction was like, well, you just have to include my favorite pickup line, which is, do you like peanut butter sandwiches, which comes up later. But yeah, wow. But their scene, any scene with Cooper Hoffman and Bradley Cooper is fucking great.
Yeah. Here's the lines that I chose to write down is, oh, you got an excuse? I'll shove an excuse right up your penis hole. Mm-hmm. Lovely. And I'm going to choke out your brother. I'm going to choke out your brother right in front of you.
Well, I also like time. Because they're there to install a waterbed. And yeah, Bradley Cooper is like, well, you guys are late because of the gas crisis. You know, they traffic's been backed up, and that's when he gives the excuse line. But he's like, just don't. I have to go meet my girlfriend Barbara Streisand at the movies, and I'm going to be late. Don't.
John, it's Streisand.
Streisand.
No. Streisand.
He's like, you know, don't fuck up my house. And I like that in the moment, you know, Gary is afraid and like, yeah, whatever. But then as soon as he's out of earshot, it's like, yeah, man, he said that shit. And I would have, you know, he's lucky that I was, you know, I don't know. That kind of posturing it always makes me laugh.
Bravado after the fact.
And then I think it just speaks to their whole thing is they're installing the waterbed. They're filling it up. It's all going fine. And then Gary's like, no, fuck you. And just pulls the hose out and just starts drenching the whole place. Like there was no need to do that, but he wanted to prove a point, and I don't know. It's a quiet thing. It's not like this huge scene. It felt like it causes repercussions later, but it doesn't. I don't know. It just felt like an empty, the empty gesture that it was. But then, so they're going to leave, and they realize they're like, are they leaving? And they figure out they're out of gas, and that's when they run into Bradley Cooper. Or is it? Oh no,
they run into Bradley Cooper, drive him to a gas station. He's being a freak. Like threatening the guy at the gas station to get, he's like, that's my nozzle. That's my fucking nozzle.
Yeah. He's got a lighter out. Yeah.
Then they fuck off going back up the hill, and he beats the shit out of Bradley Cooper's car. And that's when they realize they're out of gas, which on a character note she seems to be far more aware of the world mm-hmm. around her than someone that would just run out of gas like that. That felt a little forced.
I guess there was so much other stuff going on that, you know, you the audience could be forgiven, you know, could forgive them because you're paying attention to all this other stuff as well.
Backing down the hill was a nice little sequence.
Yeah, that's how they get out of it. But they just, yeah, you're talking about these leaps, like all, cause they get down the hill and, you know, Gary's like, oh my God, that was hardcore. You're amazing. All this stuff. But then she's just kind of not like, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? Flash to calling her, an old classmate of hers, Brian, to volunteer for a political campaign. Like, I have no idea how much time has passed in that interim.
No, that's another time jump thing where, I wonder if there is a chronology of this movie, like how long this takes in screen time.
But so she's, in an effort to kind of get away from this stupid bullshit of Gary and his friends, it's like, well, I'll get involved with this election. This guy, again, another real life person, Joel Wax, city councilman running for a Los Angeles mayor. And that's played by one of the filmmakers of Uncut Gems, Benny Safdie. He's in
Andy Kaufman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He could totally play Andy Kaufman, particularly the way that the hair is parted and all that. But he's also an actor of sorts. He's in actor of sorts. He's also an actor. He's in their other one, Good Time, and he's very good in that. But I liked him in this.
Yeah, no, he's good, and he is fighting to legalize, or he's behind the legalization of pinball, which has been illegal in California since the, you know, whatever prohibition days or, you know, some.
Because that was a huge thing here in Portland. Like, there was like pinball shakedowns where like mobsters were like, we're going to put a pinball machine in your bar and you're going to like it. Otherwise we're going to beat you.
Yeah. Cause in the oldie times it was more like pachinko. Yeah. It was a gambling thing. Not just Pabst Blue Ribbon, you know,
not just another reskin of the Shrek game.
Gary overhears that. And he starts investing in pinball machines immediately. And there is a really great fight between them where he just calls her an old lady and he kind of walks it back and then he doesn't. And he's like, no, I said m'lady. He's like, you don't fuck this. All right, old lady. And he drives off in his car and she's like, I'm never going to fucking speak to you again. It was a brutal argument. Well,
I don't remember if it's here or if it's earlier there when they're arguing and she has that line about like, I'm cooler than you. That's kind of what it boils down to, and it's so funny. But then this little episode, this little subplot, I thought was, I could have watched a whole movie about this, frankly. Because while she's working there, it seems like Wax is flirting with her, because he's like, comes over and is like, you know, since you've been here, I've been able to really focus on my work, and I want to thank you, and you're so great. And then he invites her out for drinks. It's like, okay, here's another complication. No, he invites her out to drinks because he's meeting his boyfriend, or he's having dinner with his boyfriend, and there's a reporter there, and he needs her to cover for that fact.
Great sequence. I took it a dark way at first. So she first accuses this creepy looking guy wearing a number 12 shirt that's hanging outside the office. She accuses him like, what the fuck are you looking at? Like that he's some kind of, you know, bad guy or whatever. So when the first hints, actually it's when Wax for mayor is being interviewed and the guy keeps asking about girlfriends. And I'm like, oh, he's going to be, you know, he's going to be an in-the-closet gay guy. I was afraid this was going to be a Harvey Milk thing where number 12 is going to try to kill the guy. I'm like, this movie's too fun. I'm really glad they didn't go that way. But really I had that line of thinking, I'm like, oh, no, he's at the restaurant. Oh, no, this is going to be bad.
And the scene that follows, because when she gets out there, he and his boyfriend are in the midst of an argument. And the cover story is that she's going to drive the boyfriend, who's actually in the cover story, her boyfriend picking him up to drive him home. And they have like, they're just little interaction outside his apartment about, and he's just talking about how shitty men are basically. It was just really sweet and affecting.
No, I love that part. Cause he goes, oh, they're all such shits, aren't they? And she hugs him. He's like, oh, you're so sweet. There really is a genuine moment.
That
there.
Actor is Joseph Cross. And I really liked him. I don't think I've seen him in anything else, but that scene between the two of them was great.
I love his work with Jesus.
Yeah, he really nailed it. That didn't even make sense, but whatever. But so he's, while this is all happening, Gary is opening his Fat Bernie's Pinball Palace. That's it. I don't know what the deal with Fat Bernie is, but Fat Bernie was also the name of his.
I was going to ask you that. Yeah. Is it just a name he came? I mean, or is it like a drug joke?
Don't know. I don't think it's a drug thing, but I don't know. I don't know what it's from, but So he's you know, having this grand opening, and he and Alana aren't talking, but he still wants Alana to show up. And there's a moment at the end where, like, he meets a couple of her friends, and they basically say, like, go get her. Like, go chase her. And so he's running down the street, and she's, like, running towards him. And I like that the movie, like, puts a fine point on, remember all these other times in the movie they were running? Because there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Because I was going to be like,
there's a lot of running in this movie.
If you did not wrap that up, I probably would have had a problem with it. But if you, you know, the fact that they kind of, like, see how they've always been kind of trying to reach each other. Oh, okay. Now, then I'm fine with it. Doesn't seem like a you're just dipping into that same well again. It's building to something.
Yeah. And they find each other. They hug. He takes her into the pinball, and he announces her as Alana Valentine. And she's like, oh, fuck yeah. You.
And then what I also love is no one cares. And I'm just like, okay.
Yeah, of course not. Why would they? Yeah.
But it's not this small and, thing. Yeah, like everyone cheers.
And we finally get our first very inappropriate on-screen kiss between our two lovelorn leads. And she says, to finish it, I love you, Gary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, what a strange film. What a weird way to end.
Like, it's funny because I don't feel like I went anywhere. You know, like I feel like I'm just kind of back at the beginning. But I mean, there obviously has been some sort of growth, and these people have had these experiences together. But it's like, oh, and everyone lived happily ever after. I don't believe that for a second, but I'm enjoying it all the same.
I mean, I think it's pretty clear, from my opinion on this movie. I really enjoyed it. It's not for everybody, but I quite liked it. I'm like, I want to see it again, but I also don't want to sit through it.
And ultimately, that's the caveat I'll place in it, is that although this is, like, generally glowing, I was getting antsy at several times during this. Like, it really takes its time, and some of it works, some of it doesn't. I think it's a fun journey to make, but yeah, I don't know how often I'm going to revisit it. If I'm going to rewatch a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, I don't know that it's going to be this one, just because I tend to like his harder stuff. But I like that he was able to do something a little different and still have it be as good. Maybe not as good, but also be decent anyway.
All right. So recommendations for next show. I remembered what I was talking about before. So Mr. Quentin Tarantino and his friend Roger Avery, who helped write Reservoir Dogs and I think he directed stuff. And so anyway, you know who Roger Avery is. They started a podcast.
Yeah. He almost wrote Phantasm 4.
Really? Well, I mean.
Yeah. He after winning the Academy Award, he was like, I want to do another Phantasm, which is amazing.
That's awesome. So they used to work at a video store called Video Archives back in, you know, the 80s, early 90s or whatever it was. And they just started a podcast together. There's only a few episodes out. And it's them just so Quentin, when that store shut down, he bought their entire VHS library, and he bought the VHS library of another store as well, which he keeps like in his house. And there's a screening room there. So they do two movies per episode, chosen from the wall of VHSs. Talk shit about movies, like how I think a lot of us got into it back in the, you know, late 80s, early 90s. So
what's it called?
It's called the Video Archives Podcast with Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery. But yeah, they start off with the double feature of Dark Star and Cocaine Cowboys, which interesting to hear two people talk about Dark Star.
Mm-hmm.
Quentin didn't like it until his later life, which I'm right there with him, because I don't think I understood that movie was supposed to be a comedy until probably my third time watching it. And I'm like, oh, I get it.
I got that it was comedy, but I didn't enjoy it. But I haven't revisited it since like I was a teen.
And then the next one they also do an after show, which I haven't listened to yet, but they do Moonraker, Firefox, and Delirium, I only know Moonraker, obviously. It's a good show. Quentin isn't as, when you know him from talk shows, he's not as high energy Quentin that can be somewhat annoying. He seems more like a real human that used to work at a video store.
There was a great Empire magazine had it was like a 3-hour episode, at least 3 hours, something like that. But it was him and Edgar Wright just talking about like movies they loved. I mean, it might have been like the movies of the year or something like that. I forget. But Quentin Tarantino is unfortunately, it's hard to listen to because he's like on a speakerphone or like on an iPad in a kitchen in Israel, because he was trapped in Israel when all the COVID stuff started happening because of lockdowns there.
Uh-huh.
So the sound quality isn't great, but just him and Edgar Wright just chopping it up about movies is fascinating to listen to. Cause yeah, he doesn't, it's less great. That hyperactive thing. He's still has that, but it's not as performative as it can be.
That's what this really came across as. And I mean, I've only listened to the first episode and the first episode. It's just quite long, so I thought I'd maybe listen to more than one. But recommend it very much. The Video Archives podcast with Quentin Tarantino and Roger Avery.
Awesome. We recently lost Leon Vitali this past week. And I highly recommend the documentary about him, Film Worker. He was an actor. He's in Barry Lyndon. And then he started working behind the scenes with Stanley Kubrick and is a huge part of preserving his legacy and all the weird, very perfectionist tendencies that Stanley Kubrick had, seeing those come to light. And it's a fascinating story, and he's a fascinating guy. And I highly recommend it. I had the chance to see it at the Hollywood Theater here in Portland, and he spoke afterwards. There was a little interview, and just a great dude.
What's the name of it again?
Film Worker.
Film Worker.
It's really good. And then I have been, this is a little sideways plug, I suppose, for the other podcast I'm on. This may hurt a bit, but we've been watching, going through all the Phantasm movies, which is why I know the thing about Roger Avery. And I'd seen it a few times before, but I fell in love with the first Phantasm. I something about it this time around just really clicked with me. It's very dreamy and eerie, and it's not a perfect movie, but if you can get on its wavelength, it's great.
Which one was Phantasm?
Floating balls remember. With the spikes at the end of it. The tall man.
Oh, yeah. Phantasm. I remember Phantasm. I don't remember if I liked it or not, but
other ones are weird, but the first one is solid. In fact, like J.J. Abrams was such a huge fan, and that's why Captain Phasma, and why she's wearing the silver armor, basically is based off of that.
Oh, I think I knew that.
And then because of, there's other information that comes of that ties to Phantasm, but I'm not going to talk about it on this podcast. So I'll stop.
Yeah, so you should listen to Ouch, You Hurt My Knee with John and Jim.
That's it. It's called WizBiz 2. check out Film.
This may hurt a bit.
This may hurt a bit, yeah.
This may hurt a bit is John's other show. My other show is WizBiz with Alex and Eric. You may have heard an episode last week. And if you're mad about that, go fuck yourself.
If you're mad about it, go listen to it again angrily. Download it several times just to prove a point about
exactly.
something.
Exactly. And then to really show us, you know, post it on your social feed saying, hey, this show is so bad, I really want you to listen to it. Please retweet. Yeah,
that'd be the meanest thing you could do. So really do that.
Yeah. Hey, John, what do you want to watch next episode?
I was thinking, you know, we've had a long-standing request to visit one of my favorite movies about brotherhood.
Oh, we're finally going to do it.
Dance.
All right.
We're going to watch Akira, the anime classic from 1988.
Yes, the cyberpunk classic featuring a really rad motorcycle. The second most screaming of the word Kannada after the Olympics. Yeah. It is a classic of anime, and I haven't seen it in probably 20 years. So looking forward to
reading. Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it, and we'll get into it on the show a little bit. But in high school, I watched this all the time, and particularly the shitty streamlined dub. So it's going to be hard for me to watch like a better version of this movie than I've seen before.
Oh, yeah. I don't even remember. I think I watched this. I think the last time I watched this, I think I was still in my I'm so cool, I only watch subbed anime phase, which I was in, which ladies.
Yeah. You know. But I'm glad we finally stepped up and are doing this.
You know, it's 2D, but it looks very 3D. Stepping up to the 3D animation of Akira. We'll do that next week. Remember to follow us on Twitter at JawsPod. We're on Facebook as well. And if you like the show, which you do because you're listening this far into it, make sure to share it on social media. Say like, hey, I like the show, and put it there. Or tell your friend at the office or something, because the more people listen, the more, you know, I don't know, my self-esteem will go up.
Yeah. And who doesn't want that besides Al?
Yeah, fair point. All right. See you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.